From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, Americans kidnapped and killed in Mexico. With medical tourism on the rise, where can Americans travel safely?
I will go just about anywhere with my job. Matamoros, this is a city that really is that dangerous.
International Women's Day puts a spotlight on the struggle for progress. We'll hear from one Afghan woman fighting to get girls educated.
Today in Afghanistan, a woman cannot work. She cannot be a teacher, not be a doctor. She cannot be anything. She cannot even be a student.
And Hollywood's biggest night. What's Jimmy Kimmel expecting at this year's Oscars?
Well, I'm not rooting for getting slapped, but it is fun when something weird happens.
All ahead on Perspective. On Monday, we first heard about the kidnapping of four Americans in Matamoros, Mexico, just across the border from Brownsville, Texas. ABC's Matt Rivers reported.
U.S. officials say four Americans traveling in a white minivan with North Carolina plates crossed into Mexico on Friday, shortly after gunmen began shooting at the van, kidnapping all four people inside. One Mexican bystander was also killed. President Biden briefed the FBI and State Department working with the Mexican government to find them.
The next day on Tuesday, they were found. Two of them in a house in a rural area outside Matamoros, two of them dead. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Attacks on U.S. citizens are unacceptable, no matter where or under what circumstances they happen. We will continue to work closely with the Mexican government to ensure justice is done in this case.
On Thursday, a powerful Mexican cartel took responsibility for the kidnapping and killing, and five men from that cartel, who their leaders claim were responsible for the violence, were found tied up near a pickup truck in the same area where the abduction happened. A handwritten note that multiple sources tell ABC News appears to be legitimate had been placed on the windshield of that truck, apologizing for what happened. The note reading, quote, "We have decided to deliver those involved and directly responsible," unquote. The five remain in custody. The Americans who had crossed the border were looking for cosmetic surgery. Every year, thousands of other Americans do just that. Medical tourism is real, but the CDC says you need to take precautions when you leave the country for any treatment. ABC's Matt Rivers lives in Mexico City. We talked to him about it this week. Why do Americans go to Mexico for procedures that they can get here in the U.S.? Just because it's less expensive?
Just like there's a million other things that people cross the border for, to take advantage of lower prices. Sometimes Mexicans go to the U.S. to get cheaper clothing, for example. Americans will go south to Mexico to buy cheaper prescription drugs. This industry basically takes advantage of the fact that there are millions and millions of Americans that live near the border, and they have easy access to cross into Mexico and look for cheaper ways to do things. Cosmetic surgery, one of those things. So you've seen this industry pop up really all along the border, centering more on the western part of Mexico, Tijuana. You know, drive across the border from San Diego into Tijuana, you're gonna see billboards all over the place advertising for these kinds of cosmetic procedures. But it does happen in other parts of the border, including the city of Matamoros, which is in the state of Tamaulipas. It's just south of South Texas. So if you know Brownsville, way down south in Texas, it's just across the border from there. I will go just about anywhere with my job. Matamoros, this is a city that really is that dangerous. I would really think twice before going there and have been there before, but really it's something that as a journalist, you have to take severe precautions to make sure you stay safe. It is that dangerous.
So what parts of Mexico are not so unsafe? When people hear something like this, kidnapping, they think the whole country must be dangerous. And that's really not the case, is it, Matt?
My family and I live here, and I travel a lot. I'm a foreign correspondent. I'm always on the road. I would never live in a country and leave my wife and child behind in a place where I didn't think they were safe. There are places in Mexico that are completely safe, and I think it's very important. Just like if you were to explain the United States to someone who was not from the United States, you would not say the entire United States is the same thing. You would not say that someone from Alabama is the same as someone from Washington. You wouldn't say that something that happens in Minneapolis necessarily affects something that happens in Phoenix. Mexico is a country of 150 million people. Well, 130, 150, depending on your count. It's a huge place. And so just because something happens at the border doesn't mean that if you take that flight to Cancun or you take that flight to Cabo San Lucas or you come here to Mexico City where I live, it's just as dangerous. So what the State Department does is they do this for every country around the world. They issue travel guidance, their guidelines essentially, levels 1 through 4. Level 4 being a do not travel. So level 4 being the kind of place like Syria, Afghanistan, North Korea. Level 1 being a place that they think there is absolutely no risk to Americans for traveling. And then there's levels 2 and 3, something in between there. The thing that they do in Mexico that is different than the vast majority of other countries is the State Department rates Mexico on a state by state basis. So there's some like 32 or 33 states in Mexico. So there's, I think, half a dozen states in Mexico right now that are rated as level 4, including the state of Tamaulipas, which is where Matamoros is, which is where this kidnapping happened. But there are other places in Mexico that are not that bad. So Cancun, for example, rated a level 2. Cabo San Lucas, which is in Baja California Sur, level 2. You know what else is level 2? Germany, the UK, France, Italy, Denmark, Belgium, most of Europe is listed as a level 2. So I think a lot of Americans wouldn't say, oh, wow, I'm not going to go to Denmark. It might be unsafe. Doesn't mean bad things can't happen in Denmark. Doesn't mean bad things can't happen in Cancun. And they do. And there have been shootings there recently. But it doesn't mean that it's as dangerous as the border states.
So what should people do if they want to keep themselves safe when they take a trip to Mexico, even to a resort or something like that?
A lot of this stuff, I mean, it is not necessarily Mexico specific. It's stuff that you would probably apply anytime you're traveling in general, right? Don't take too much cash with you. Don't be obvious. You know, use trusted taxi services. Don't go exploring on your own into neighborhoods that maybe you don't know all that much about. That's kind of common sense stuff, and yet this does happen. And, you know, a final thing, especially if you're going to areas that are known for partying, look, if you go down the street in Playa del Carmen and you're looking for drugs, there's violence that is often associated with that. I mean, the reason why drugs are being sold in these areas is because tourists come to Mexico looking for drugs. Not to victim blame or anything like that, but if you put yourself in a position where you go to neighborhoods that you shouldn't be in, if you're engaging in activity that you know is associated with violent crime, you increase your chances of being in trouble. Doesn't mean you can't leave the resort. You know, you don't have to be trapped in your little tourist bubble, but I think you just need to use common sense. That would be my biggest advice. Use common sense. You're smart. Follow your instincts. That's what I would say.
ABC's Matt Rivers, our foreign correspondent based in Mexico City. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much.
The bodies of those two Americans killed in Matamoros were returned to the United States on Thursday. It was in March of 2020 that 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was shot and killed in her boyfriend's home during the execution of a no-knock warrant in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, 3 years later, the Justice Department has issued a scathing report on the Louisville Police Department and its handling of that case and others. ABC's Steve Osunsami has more on that, starting with Attorney General Merrick Garland.
This conduct is unacceptable.
The results from the U.S. Justice Department aren't flattering at all to Louisville Police.
The report concludes that the unit's activities were part of an overall enforcement approach that resulted in significant and unlawful racial disparities.
Federal authorities found that police in the city were 4 to 5 times more likely to stop black drivers than white ones for the same traffic violations, 5 times more likely to charge black people for loitering or disorderly conduct, and more likely to stop and search black Americans for the same behaviors. The U.S. Attorney General flew into Kentucky to share the bad review.
Some officers have demonstrated disrespect for the people they are sworn to protect. Some have videotaped themselves throwing drinks at pedestrians from their cars, insulted people with disabilities, and called black people monkeys, animal, and boy.
The federal investigation began after the death of Breonna Taylor at the hands of police in 2020.
I don't know what's happening. Somebody kicked in the door and shot my girlfriend.
She had no connection to the crime police were investigating, but died as police were trying to execute a no-knock warrant looking for a drug suspect. Justice officials found that more than 60% of no-knock search warrants and forced entries into buildings involved black people. Taylor's mother is not surprised.
It's heartbreaking to know that everything you've been saying from day one has to be said again. Through this manner.
The city's new mayor says he'll work with the Justice Department to put changes in place.
We will reform how we recruit, train, equip, support, supervise, and deploy the more than 1,000 public servants whose job it is to serve as guardians of the public safety every day and every night.
That was ABC's Steve Osunsami reporting. Coming up, the move to restrict drag shows in Tennessee. A drag queen weighs in on perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
RuPaul's Drag Race, drag brunches, drag queen story hours, all of them have been the target of certain lawmakers who think they're dangerous. But no state has gone as far as Tennessee in trying to ban them completely. On ABC's Daily Podcast Art Here, host Brad Milkey did a deep dive this week on a recent law that was passed that imposes new restrictions on adult cabaret performances. Critics say it amounts to an outright ban on drag shows. Brad also talked to a performer who's deeply affected by this law.
Last week, Tennessee lawmakers passed a new law that bans certain types of performances in public space, or any place really where a child might see them. Included in this ban are topless acts, strippers, or, quote, male or female impersonators who provide entertainment that appeals to prurient interests, end quote, which could be interpreted as a long way of saying drag shows. The word drag is not in this bill, but it appears that at least some drag shows would be effectively banned in spaces open to children in Tennessee. In any case, this comes at a moment where lawmakers in Tennessee and elsewhere are describing gay, trans, and gender nonconforming people as not just different, but dangerous. Proponents of this bill describe the need to protect children from over-sexualized content. Many LGBTQ Americans, though, feel like their art forms and even their gender identity have come under attack. Tennessee is not the only state that's proposed laws like this. There will almost certainly be more. So, as this bill takes effect this week, we wanted to find out how what can seem kind of like abstract culture wars will affect real people's lives. We are joined by Memphis drag artist Slade Kyle. Slade, you do a lot of live shows, right? Can you describe your act for me?
Sure. I am a full-time drag performer, and I perform as Bella DeBall.
That's literally all I do. I look pretty, I talk on the mic, and I book one hell of a drag show.
And I am the show host at the Atomic Rose. So I would say that my drag persona is kind of the intersection between Miss Piggy, Dolly Parton, and Mr. Rogers.
Somebody order a giant angry woman.
Most of what I do is classic Southern drag. Big hair, big flashy gowns, ballads, and just a general good time and some Southern charm.
But whatever happens, we are queer people. We are very strong, and we will rise.
And if this is not somebody's scene, just so we're all clear, like as a drag queen on stage, you're going by Bella DeBall, this sort of female character. How do you identify offstage?
Yeah, offstage, I'm non-binary. I use they, them pronouns.
Right. What was your reaction then to this law being passed?
I wish I could say that I was surprised. When we heard the legislation introduced, I feared that living in such a red state, it would probably pass and that the governor would indeed sign it. We're one of 19 states that are currently looking at such legislation, and I was hoping we would not be the first, but look at us out here pioneering.
You may have incorrectly heard that this bill bans drag shows in Tennessee. It does no such thing. What the bill does is simply say that if you're going to perform any type of sexually explicit adult-oriented entertainment, you can't have kids around. That's all it does.
My initial reaction to this was a lot of fear, a lot of anger, you know, and we were worried. We were worried about our livelihood.
Is there a sense of how it would affect an act like yours or any of these acts in town? Because it's rather ambiguous language. I mean, is there a sense of what would actually happen in a given scenario?
Yeah, the language is so ambiguous because, as you pointed out, it says that it's adult cabaret performances that appeal to prurient interest. And here in Tennessee, prurient means a morbid or shameful interest in sex. Mm. And so the district attorney has, here, Steve Mulroy in Memphis, made a statement that there is not a single drag show happening in this county that is in violation of this law.
I think it's a solution in search of a problem. I think we've got so much on our plate right now that we should be focusing on drag racing, not drag shows.
Because drag performances are not prurient. They are not sexual by nature, and so this law does not apply to us.
Yeah, I was going to say, because this law says it's aimed at keeping children away from over-sexualized material. Like, would that be a problem?
Well, no, see, we already have obscenity laws here in Tennessee. We have laws that firmly prohibit you from being able to do any sexual display in front of a minor. Our shows and our festivals have always adhered to those laws. So we were questioning why this new legislation.
I don't want to ban a theater company from doing a production of Mrs. Doubtfire in a public park. I think most people have seen that movie. No, Robin Williams was dressing up as a woman. We don't have an issue with that. It's like they say about pornography. You know it when you see it.
It's all under this guise of we have to protect the children. We got to protect the children.
This is what happens in Bill Lee's Tennessee.
So last week, four protesters, including myself, went to the grand opening of the YMCA in Whitehaven here in Memphis because we heard word that the governor would be there speaking. And my question to the governor was, can you produce any evidence of a child being harmed or abused at a drag show? He can't cite one. Not a single instance has this ever occurred. So we're battling this amorphous thing that does not exist rather than tackling real issues that face our kids here in Tennessee.
It applies to all entertainers, regardless of how they dress. And quite frankly, it's a very common sense piece of legislation.
Their attempt is to say that all drag is indeed adult cabaret. You know, the purpose of this bill is to try and classify all drag entertainers. There's another one now that just passed the House that will require all of us to get adult cabaret licenses. So we'll have to go before the stripper board and get an adult stripper license.
Wait, you would have to get a stripper license for your drag act?
Yes. I'm a minister and I have to go get a stripper's license to continue doing drag.
If you have one of those, you cannot also have an alcohol license. So our bar couldn't even serve liquor anymore. This is an attempt to erase drag in Tennessee.
And the whole thing is being done under this supposed guise of we have to protect these kids. But again, I reiterate, it's an invisible threat. Our show is an all ages show. That means that if a kid is under 18, they have to be accompanied by an adult. They can't just wander in off the street. Drag queens aren't just walking into public schools and things uninvited. These are things that you have to bring a child to.
Well, and public libraries are actually kind of an interesting example because we've seen, you know, these things called drag queen story hour. Drag queens show up in full drag to read children's books. It's been criticized by people who are made uncomfortable by it. It's often praised by parents who bring their kids. But that's not something that seems overtly sexual, even if it is gender bendy. So I'm wondering, like, do you have a sense that would be illegal under this bill?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No drag in public. Yeah. So when I get invited to go to the library to read, they wouldn't want me doing that anymore. They don't want me marching in the parade anymore. Nothing in public that a child could view.
Because that's considered prurient.
Right. My existence is considered prurient, right? That's the whole thing. It's like just being a drag queen, not that I'm doing anything sexual. They're implicating that that I am inherently sexual or inappropriate.
Where do you think that's coming from, though? Like bills like this and attitudes like this from these elected officials? Because I do think there's like lots of Americans who are like, yeah, sorry, I just don't like want my kid to have to be confused about gender and being like preached to by this drag queen that comes in and says, yeah, this is normal. Or like, where do you think this response is sort of coming from?
I think it's an attempt to control what their kid's worldview is. We're not trying to expose a child to anything other than maybe the ability to see themselves. For me, I had no examples of queer representation growing up, and it would have done me a lot of good to see a person that exemplified, I have a future. Mm. I too could belong here in Tennessee. Maybe this isn't the end for me. So when I hear this idea that it's about the kids, it's about protecting the kids, I want to know about the queer kids. What about the trans kids that are here in Tennessee? Don't tell me they don't exist. I meet them at my brunches every single week. The Trevor Project released that last year, 45% of queer youth contemplated suicide. one out of five trans or gender nonconforming teens attempted suicide. And we're not at this highly increased risk because of our gender identity or our sexual orientation. It's because we live in a society that allows people to dehumanize us openly, and it undervalues us. That is what weighs on us. And we know that these kids are less likely to be at risk for suicide if anyone in their life affirms them. Homosexuality is not vampirism. You know, you cannot turn a kid queer. You can't do that. No one's trying to turn kids queer. We're trying to keep queer kids alive. And if you expose a child to queer culture, and they're not inherently going to be queer already, the worst that it could do to them is inform their worldview that there are people out there that are different than them, that they might have to learn to get along with one day.
That was Bella DeBall from Memphis, Tennessee, speaking with ABC's Brad Milkey. Coming up, the Boston Strangler, the still unsolved murders from the early 60s, the subject of a new podcast and movie on Perspective after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, what is Jimmy Kimmel hoping for this time around when he hosts the Oscars on Sunday? But first, we're taking you back 60 years. Boston, 1962 through 1964. More than a dozen women choked to death, many of them in their own homes. The murderer was nicknamed the Boston Strangler. And to this day, one man has been identified as the killer of one woman. The rest of the cases remain open. ABC Audio has released a new podcast called Truth and Lies, The Boston Strangler. Here's a preview.
It was a crime spree that stumped police for years.
It was novel to have a serial killer continue to kill while the police are looking for him.
They had hundreds and hundreds of suspects.
More than a half century ago, 13 women opened their doors to the man who would end their lives. The killer's signature brutal method? Strangling them with their own nylon stockings, bathrobe ties, and scarves.
The podcast is a collaboration with 20th Century Studios. Its film, Boston Strangler, will be streaming on Hulu March 17th. The host of Truth and Lies, The Boston Strangler, Dick Lehr, is an author and journalist in Boston, where the murders took place. I talked to him this week. You're also going to hear from some key characters in the podcast, including John DiNatale, a Boston police detective's son. His father was investigating the killings as they took place. But first, Dick explains why this case is still on the minds of so many people decades after it happened.
Part of it is the fact that there's this unresolved quality to it. You have this big confession by a serial rapist by the name of Albert DeSalvo. And from then until now, there's this unresolved debate about whether he was truly the Boston Strangler. So that always kind of keeps it alive in a weird way. And part of what the podcast does, and I think what the Matt Reskin's film does, is to take us back in time to the early 1960s. And it's recaptured the fear that overtook the city and beyond.
First couple of murders, okay. Now, fifth, sixth murder, now people are walking down the street in Boston and they're walking in groups. You go to the animal shelter to get a dog. There are no dogs to be taken because everybody has a dog. Women in the Back Bay were taking Coke bottles, breaking them up, and putting the broken, jagged glass on their windowsills so that if somebody tried to come in a window, they were going to step on the broken glass. This was the nature of the fear in Boston at the time.
Then there was a frenzy that followed it. There were like a half dozen newspapers in the city at the time, morning and afternoon editions that were constantly pushing the story and the discovery of a new victim, radio and television. It drew national interest at the time. So there was this sort of media frenzy surrounding the case that wasn't just a one-off. It went on for weeks and weeks and months and months. And then there's this sense of futility because it went unsolved for so long and then maybe perhaps unsolved to this day.
What sort of techniques did you use to retell the story that's coming up on 60 years? I mean, it's been around for a long time, but you're retelling it. Seems like a new story now. How did you go about that?
Well, there's this, you know, ABC has great resources and wonderful archival material that they were able to round up.
On January 4th, 1964, another body in Boston, Mary Sullivan's, 44A Charles Street, Apartment 2.
Her nephew, Casey Sherman, told ABC News in 2001 about the toll her death took on his family.
It's a loss my mother never got over. Her 19-year-old sister left her quiet Cape Cod hometown for life in the big city. 4 days later, she was murdered.
She had been strangled with a stocking and two scarves, propped up against her left foot, a greeting card. It said, "Happy New Year."
Recapturing some of that original radio or television, you know, footage was really helpful. Teamed up with a criminologist, a nationally recognized criminologist, James Allen Fox at Northeastern University, who's written a lot and studied serial killers and the strangling case in particular. We went on location to where the first killing occurred in Boston's Fenway area.
We're standing out across from what was once 77 Gainsborough Street in Boston. It's been renamed 79, and for good reason. What is that reason, James?
It was the first victim of the Boston Strangler. And because it was the first, it has special significance. And the number was changed, perhaps to avoid people coming here and tourists taking pictures, and perhaps also to that it wouldn't discourage renters.
We went off to Chelsea, where, you know, Albert DeSalvo, the confessed strangler, you know, grew up and did a stand up outside of his boyhood home. And then there was, in largely in my mind, overlooked contributions of a couple of female reporters.
This is Loretta in a 1985 interview with North TV, describing how she went up to her editor and asked if she could look into the murders.
And he sort of said, "Why?" He said, "Loretta." He said, "They are nobodies." And I said, "That's the whole point. Why should anyone be going around killing women who are nobody?"
She was one of the more direct people in the news business I ever met.
Tom Mulvoy is the former managing editor of the Boston Globe, where Loretta later worked.
Loretta was right there in the middle, swinging her elbows if she had to, or patting you on the head one way or the other. She had this habit with people of grabbing you by the crook of your arm and dragging you into the nearest office and closing the door. And you said, "Holy cow, what's Loretta up to now?"
Which is the, you know, the angle that Matt Ruskin takes in his new film as a way to get into this story yet again. With Keira Knightley starring as Loretta McLaughlin, who with a colleague, Gene Cole, you know, did some real breakout coverage of the Stranglers at the time.
When they wrote the first big series on the serial killings, the lead headline declared, "Two girl reporters analyze Strangler." But the readers would come to know them as more than just two girl reporters. In fact, they'd become a vital source of information about the killer's every move.
That's a fresh take on this story in the sense that it was always there, but largely overlooked.
The podcast is part of the Truth and Lies series. It's The Boston Strangler, a companion series on Hulu. Comes out on March 17th, next week. Good reporting. Again, Dick Lehr, a pleasure to talk to you about this latest podcast that you put out for ABC Audio. Thanks.
Thank you, Sherry. Good to talk to you again.
Coming up, a brave teacher in Afghanistan risking her life to educate girls. On Perspective after this. This week we celebrated International Women's Day, a global day celebrating the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women. In honor of that, we want to take you to a place, however, where women's rights have been severely deteriorating. Inside Taliban-occupied Afghanistan, women have been disappearing from the workplace, from schools, and from public life. With their rights under attack more than ever, we want to introduce you to a brave 25-year-old woman. She is the founder behind a network of underground schools, and she's giving hundreds of women and girls a chance to dream again. She spoke with an ABC News crew in Afghanistan recently, and her story can be found on abcnews.com. She's now in a safe place, so we're letting you hear her voice. But if the Taliban found out who she is or the identity of her students or teachers, they could all be arrested simply for the act of learning, which has now been made illegal by their own government. Here's a part of that teacher's story.
One of my teachers called me and they said, can you watch the TV right now? I was like, yeah, sure. What's happening? She was crying and she said, like, just watch the TV. I saw that there were girls coming out of schools and they were crying. They had been asked to go back to their houses. I was shocked. Today in Afghanistan, a woman cannot work anywhere. She cannot be a teacher, not be a doctor, not be an astronaut, not be an army. She cannot be an engineer. She cannot be a designer. She cannot be a businesswoman. She cannot be anything. She cannot even be a student. The fall of Kabul was not an easy thing for us, young generation, especially who were educated and they had their dreams, that now it was all vanished. On 21st of December, another shocking decree came up where they closed the doors of the universities for girls. I was really disappointed, but it was expected. I find it impossible for myself not to help. I cannot sit and just watch. When I started the first school, I was searching for teachers. I contacted many of my friends that they had a master's degrees, and they came together. We made a group in WhatsApp. And within 2 hours, it was more than 600 people.
Assalamu alaikum.
All of a sudden, one day, some of the Taliban approached our school. Fortunately, we were not inside the school. So after that, many of the girls were scared and they could not come by the door. I wanted to hide this from my family, but if anything happened to me, my family have to know about all this. So most of the time when we sit together, the first thing my mother is looking at me and then she's like, can you please stop that? Can you please not do that and not continue that? And because she's scared. If I stop this work, many of the girls will be forced to get married. Many of them will be dead while they are delivering a baby in a rural area where they do not have access to any clinic. Then there are some small children. They are my favorite personalities. I think about them. And I'm like, so what will happen to them? In the past, I had some dreams, which I don't have anymore. My biggest dream might be freedom. That's all.
Since ABC filmed that story, the founder of the program shared with us that there was a raid on one of the schools they operate. No women were there when that raid took place, but there's no certainty that schools like that will continue to run with limited resources and the Taliban cracking down. Coming up, does Jimmy Kimmel have a philosophy on hosting the Oscars? He does. We'll tell you what it is on Perspective after this. Sunday night, Hollywood's biggest night, the Oscars, the awards show that all the other awards shows look up to, and the one that our entertainment correspondent, ABC's Jason Nathanson, looks forward to the most. Because it's just so, well, it's so Hollywood. Jason got a chance to talk with Academy Awards host Jimmy Kimmel this week, and we got a chance to talk with Jason about it. Jimmy Kimmel hosting this year. He's hosted before. What is it about this year that is going to be different from years past?
I asked him about, like, what are the themes this year? Like, what does he notice? And what is he going to be talking about? What is he going to be joking about? One of the things he said that he loves that this year, there are 16 first-time nominees in the acting category. And he talked about how that is exciting for him.
One of the traps that award shows in general fall into is people kind of checking the same boxes year after year after year, sometimes without even necessarily seeing the movies. So I think it's pretty great that you've got all these actors and producers, directors, et cetera, who have never been nominated before. I think it makes for a much more open field and for some exciting moments. I mean, it's more exciting to see somebody win their first Oscar than their sixth.
That's where you get the good speeches, right? When somebody gets up there and they're so overwhelmed, they've never been on the stage before. Even if they're a cinematographer or somebody you've never heard of, when they show real emotion and they don't just read from a list of people to thank.
And the Oscar goes to
Rami Malek.
Oh my God. My mom is in here somewhere. I love you. I love you, lady.
To Viola Davis.
I became an artist, and thank God I did, because we are the only profession that celebrates what it means to live a life.
That's when you get the best Oscars moments.
Going into it, does Jimmy Kimmel have a philosophy in terms of how he wants the show to go?
He does. He has certain things that he wants to hit, and when it comes to his comedy, there's certain ways he wants to play it.
Number one is you want to make the audience laugh. Number two is you have to remember that this is a celebratory night for these people. It's not a roast. Doesn't mean there won't be a little roasting, but you got to make sure that you don't humiliate anybody and that everybody comes away happy.
And that part about not roasting people, that's very central to his core philosophy there, because, you know, especially in the wake of the Will Smith Chris Rock slap, that all came out of a joke Chris Rock made out about Will Smith's wife, Jada Pinkett Smith. And, you know, he wants to avoid anything that might get people into the mood for violence, let's say.
Yeah, when you think about what happened last year, it was like when you talk about the movies themselves, people don't discuss that. They only talk about the slap, even what happened beforehand. In terms of that, did he learn anything from that going forward? And will there be any differences this year than last year?
You know, he was the host during Envelope Gate, which was, until last year, kind of the biggest thing that had ever happened at the Oscars that was non-movie related.
But explain, before we go further, explain what happened again.
So this was that was the year, I think it was 2018, where they mixed up the envelopes and it was announced that La La Land won for Best Picture when it was actually Moonlight. And you had this really kind of awkward thing going on stage where nobody really knew what was going on.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won. This is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
And Kimmel was the host during that.
This is very unfortunate what happened. Personally, I blame Steve Harvey for this.
And I told him, I said, with that, you know, I was there backstage for that, and I was there backstage for the Will Smith thing. And as reporters, as long as nobody really gets hurt, like, we kind of root for chaos a little bit. It makes things a little interesting. So I asked him if, as host, if he roots for chaos as well.
Well, I'm not rooting for getting slapped, but it is fun when something weird happens, you know. And of course, there's always, but the truth of the matter is somebody's always on the bad side of it. I mean, what happened to the La La Land and Moonlight guys? That wasn't great for either one of them. You know what kind of stuff I like? Streaking. I like when naked people run on the stage. I would like to see more of that.
So and that kind of maybe invites streakers. So I asked him if there is a streaker this year, or say somebody doesn't like a joke that he told and wants to run up on stage, has he seen any measures put in place to stop people from getting on that stage?
You'd think that. I've seen no evidence that that is true. I think people will be more alert. I think they'll be more on their toes. I don't think this is the year to worry about. I really think like the time that we should be worried is in 4 years when people have kind of forgotten about it. Once we let our defenses down, that's when somebody will strike again. Maybe Jazzy Jeff this time. Who knows?
So, you know, he's relaxed. He's doing jokes. And we'll see what he has to say on Sunday.
ABC's Jason Nathanson, our entertainment correspondent from Hollywood. Thank you as always, friend.
Of course.
The 95th Academy Awards will air Sunday night on ABC. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show is produced by Aaron Ferrer and Marwa Mwaki. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.